In this episode, my guest is Alan R. Warren, and we discuss true crime, including a murder of a 60s TV star that you either never heard of or don't remember. Plus, Justine does a book recommendation and had to create a new category for it. Welcome to Queer Writers of Crime, where we feature LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Justine, Alan R. Warren is my guest today. You know who he is.
Oh, yes. He has the other mystery podcast.
Yep, the House of Mystery radio show. It's actually pretty broad. He's on NBC Radio in a lot of the local markets here in California. And then a few days after that airs, he's pretty much on all the podcast sites.
Right.
And he is a little different because he's nonfiction, which I usually don't do. This is not going to be a change in format. But Alan has been really supportive of queer crime writers. And in fact, he has some on his show and interviews them. He does nonfiction, like crime, science, paranormal. Crime. Yeah, he does true crime.
He does true crime. And then, you know, he's branched out, I think, in the last year or two into fiction.
Yeah, and he does like horror and sci-fi, even does romance, and he also does LGBT fiction as well. So that's why I invited him to be on the show.
Wonderful. I'm looking forward to hearing him be the interviewee this time.
We had a good conversation. He sent me three or four books, and one of them was his newest book, and I was going to read that first, but there was another book that caught my eye, and I absolutely had to read it, and because it talks about Kurt Cobain.
Oh.
I'm a huge Nirvana fanatic. They're my favorite band.
Wow.
And so once I saw Kurt's name.
I'm surprised you have time for something like that with all your Paul Rudd worship.
You know what I do? I listen to Kurt while I look at Paul on YouTube. So anyway, as soon as I saw that, I had to read that book. But then I did read his other book as well. His most recent book that we talk about, it's about some horrible murders that happened in Canada. And that's very interesting. We talk about Kurt Cobain. And the other one I think that listeners will find interesting is there is a 60s television star who was really wild and kinky and was bludgeoned to death. I remember this really well. And I talk to people and nobody seems to remember it. At all.
I do remember this story, but I don't recall the name of the actor right now.
Well, everybody, after we're done here, everybody can listen in and they'll find out who it was.
That sounds terrific. And let me guess that couple in Canada, was that the couple, you say the gruesome Canadian murders, but was it the married couple who abducted girls and did it together?
No.
Okay.
It's a totally different one.
Boy. They got so many gruesome murders up there in Canada. Good thing we don't have anything like that here in the U.S.
Yeah, and I want to give people a warning. We do talk about gruesome murders, but we don't get gross about it. So just want to make sure people are like, oh, I don't want to hear about that. I got one more thing to say to you. I really missed you at the recording yesterday.
Oh, you know, that was a 3-hour time investment, unfortunately. And I just did not have 3 hours this week. Had it been another week, I would have probably done it.
Yeah, I want to tell the listeners, there's a podcast called So Horrified. And what they do on So Horrified is they watch really bad horror films and have guests on the show and you discuss the movie. And I had asked Justine, would you like to join us? And she had a hellacious work week. And it was also one of those weeks where she was struggling to find a good book.
But I found one.
Yes. It was like an unanswered prayer because she couldn't find one. And then, boom, she found one that she really enjoys. She told me she's looking forward to talking about it. This show comes out this Friday the 21st or Saturday the 22nd, and I'm talking in May 2021, and it's called So Horrified. They allow the guests to choose the movie if they'd like, and I did. I chose Blood Beach from around 1981. I remember watching it in high school. I don't remember it being as bad as it was.
Yeah.
We had so much fun. So if anybody wants to watch it, it's Blood Beach. The company that filmed the movie went under immediately after this movie came out. So the only way you can find it is on YouTube, or you can just listen in when we talk about it. And it comes out this Friday and Saturday. I'll do another reminder next Tuesday. Justine, I wish you could have joined us. And now you can talk about books.
Now we can talk about, well, at least one book.
Okay, one book, yes.
Okay, so as you say, I got really lucky this week, as I often do, because I go through so many titles. It is a paranormal book, and it's been a long time since I've done a paranormal book. And so it was really very much the fun ride. It's called Chasing Ghosts by Dean Cole. It is book one of the Quentin Strange mysteries. And the main character, as you might guess, is Quentin Strange. From the cover, he looks a lot like Harry Potter. And he is a photographer with a new job at a local newspaper. And he's out with the up-and-coming, hard-driving reporter who is a little bitchy to him. It's their first assignment together. But she's also a little full of herself. She makes her not particularly unlikable. It just makes her annoying. One of those people that you want to sigh about. So they are going off to be in a haunted house. This is in England. They're going to spend a weekend at a haunted house. And there's going to be a ghost hunter team there. Four people from, I think it's the Plucky Ghost Investigators. They have a medium along for the ride. And then there are three other people who are part of this ghost. There are other guests at this large manor, but three other people who are at this ghost adventure kind of weekend. A cutesy young rich couple who are just all over each other and have this little Pomeranian dog. And then this gorgeous young man who is a author. Writes paranormal mysteries, but is at a writer's block. So he's got to come along here and try to, you know, get some inspiration again because his deadline in his second book is coming up. So these are our three main characters. Quentin is the photographer. Kat is the reporter. And Will is the handsome stranger. There's a little bit of romance. I think they even said heart flutter at some point. But... You know, that's a tiny part of it. It's really more of a friendship developing. There's not really a fall in love, happily ever after kind of moment. I believe that it's more like the guy that in your first book who ran the bathhouse, who then shows up again in the second book. But it's not a romance.
Your heart can flutter without it turning into a real romance. I mean,
yes,
my heart flutters every time I see Paul Rudd.
I just can't believe that's a running shtick around here. Of all the running shticks. So anyway, they're off at this mansion. And one of the things I really, really like about it is that the ghosts are real. And it's not a Scooby-Doo kind of ending. I know you prefer a Scooby-Doo husky kid, but the ghosts are real throughout this whole thing. So it is a adventurous little tale. Quentin had been having visions and dreams for a while. His first love died in a horrible boating accident, which you'll read about. And he hasn't been with anybody else for any of the time since. And now he's recently started having dreams about this guy. And then other premonitions and other dreams. At some point, he even started taking psychiatric medication to try to put those to bed. But he stops taking it after the first night here because there's just too much going on for him to sense. It overrides the medication, but he can't quite understand what's going on. And it was much safer to get all the warnings that all the spirits were handing out than it would have been to take that medication. The three of them managed to work together. Again, it's not like Scooby-Doo team. They're all kind of on the same page, but going at it from their different directions. The ghost hunters are not particularly intriguing, but the medium is quite intriguing. She appears to be a real medium. And some of the philosophicals in the middle of it, the medium is talking very philosophically about the afterlife and the like. And she's got some very interesting connections between ghosts which linger on and the soul which passes on. There are people who believe in the soul passing on who think that doesn't mean that ghosts exist, and people who believe that the ghost is stuck here, so they haven't passed on yet. And she had a very different take, and they spend a lot of time in long talks about her philosophy and approach to life. It is, at its end, scary. Don't read it in the dark. It's creepy, and you don't know what's going to happen next. It is quite the read. It is getting a my new category of a recommendation, a spooky recommendation.
Spooky.
Yep.
That's a fun one.
Yes.
I'm amazed. It's been this long since you've done a paranormal, because you really like paranormal.
One, I do like paranormals, and I did a bunch in a row, but I've had trouble after reading what, you know, seemed to be the cream of the crop. I had trouble finding another one that was really worth recommending, and this one is.
And I'm going to really have to try it out, because I have never read a paranormal mystery. I have looked on Amazon, and from the blurbs and the opening pages, there clearly are a lot of bad ones out there.
Oh, yes.
I know from your suggestions there are plenty of good ones as well. But I'm
but I think this one is a good starting point, because it's really a mystery involving ghosts.
Okay, so Chasing Ghosts, I'm writing it down, and I'm notating that it's spooky.
And it's Dean Cole. And you can find his website at deancolebooks.com and find out a little more about him. I'm hoping that he's going to continue writing this series before he turns his eye towards anything else.
As we tell our listeners, send him a message and let him know.
Oh, yeah. And please pick up this book if you like the paranormals. Well, I think it's been a while before we told our listeners what Recruit Tales is. It's a small publishing company. There are three of us who own it and do everything ourselves. And what we do is we bring back classic mysteries. Our sweet spot is from the Stonewall Riots to the turn of the century. We have some after that, however. And we have some, you know, sci-fi mysteries and the like. I try to mostly talk about the mysteries on here. Many of these books were languishing and off the market for a long time before we brought them back. The one coming out this week is a novel by Nikki Baker. It's the third in her Virginia Kelly series. It's called Long Goodbyes. I've talked about that a lot. Cheryl Head is then the forward. And then after that, our next release will be Little Miss Evil by Lev Raphael. It's the fourth in his Nick Hoffman series. And it's a great mystery. And the forward on that one is going to be by Meg Perry.
Oh, Meg Perry. She was a guest. Cheryl Head was a guest.
Yes.
And Lev Raphael has been a guest twice. And he's coming up again, I think, in 3 weeks. Because he has a new book as well as the book that you're doing coming out. So
right.
I love what you guys have done at Recruit Tales. And as you said, it's mostly old mysteries, though you do make exceptions for like sci-fi when it's like an amazing author like Felice Picano.
And we also do some literary mysteries. Robert Farrow is a writer that we have brought back and has been very, very popular with our buyers.
Well, thank you for doing that.
Well, you're welcome.
Okay, again, the guest is Alan R. Warren. He's coming up right after the transition here. And also listen to So Horrified this upcoming weekend and hear me talk about Blood Beach. Interact with other crime fiction fans and authors in our Game Mystery Thriller Suspense Fiction group on Facebook. Links are on our website, queerwritersofcrime.com. Alan R. Warren is the author of 12 published true crime books. Five of them have been number one bestsellers and has produced and hosted several radio markets, including KKNW 1150 AM in Seattle, KFNX 1100 AM in Phoenix, and KOII 94.5 FM in Flagstaff. Thank you for being on the show, Alan.
Oh, it's my pleasure. My pleasure.
You're one of the few guests I've had on the show that isn't a fiction writer. And I want to let people know why. Alan has been very active, at least on Facebook, involved in some of the gay websites and author websites. His House of Mystery radio show covers paranormal, crime, religion, science, history, in a variety of media outlets. But in addition to that, he features interviews with queer LGBTQ crime writers as well. So that's why I'd like to have him on this week. And Alan had me on a guest on his show, and he'd never said, I want to be a guest on your show, but I invited him anyway.
That's because I'm shy.
So here we are. You sent me several of your books, and your most recent book is Murder Times 6. And it's about a grisly murder of six people in the Canadian wilderness. And it was my intent to read that book right away, but I got distracted. I'm going to tell you why. You also sent Mysterious Celebrity Deaths. When I opened that up, the very first person is Kurt Cobain. I'm a Nirvana fanatic. It wasn't even a choice. I had to go straight for the Kurt Cobain story. I want to ask about that. Like most Nirvana fans, I was and am not a fan of Courtney Love. But I do think the rumors that Courtney had Kurt murdered were ridiculous. Now I'm conflicted because the interviews you had in that book, 1 minute I absolutely believed he was murdered, not necessarily by Courtney. And the next minute, I was absolutely certain it was suicide. Can you shed some light on the story and the controversy related to that?
Yeah, that's a tough one. It's complicated. But the bottom line is, the evidence shows that it was suicide. It does not show that he was killed. And if you've read the first part, you know that I know Courtney. And so because I knew her, I was trying to stay out of using my opinion in the interviews. I wasn't trying to go that way. But I'll tell you, if one thing that that sticks out is every person, like Soaked in Bleach, the documentary, and every person associated with that, including the private detective, Green, they all lied, and they created a story to tell, and they changed every person they had on that documentary. They changed their interview to make it sound like they thought it was suicide. And so that in itself, you know, especially in these crazy days of all of this conspiracy and stuff going on out there, when someone actually lies, they create a story to try and get their point across, I X them out. So I can't, you know, maybe it didn't come across that way, but in a lot of those interviews, those people were lied and they made up a story. So to me, I can show you the story that they said that they were telling us, but they lied. And for me, that means you get X'd out. That's like an Alex Jones thing. It's kind of like, if you're creating a story, I don't trust you. And anything you have to say, I can't take that on any value. So for me, the only evidence we have is that he killed himself. You know, and it's really easy, especially nowadays, because people love to cancel, they love to hate who they don't understand and who they don't like. And Courtney Love is not the most likable person. I can tell you that personally, she's up and down like a toilet seat. She can just go off in a second. It's very hard to deal with that. And I understand why a lot of people don't like her, because she'll scream at someone, call them names. She just goes off, totally uncontrolled. And I get it. So, but you cannot convict someone because you hate them. And that's sort of kind of our trend lately. It seems to be what everyone's doing because, oh, I don't like this person. Everybody jumps on them and everything. But that doesn't change the facts. It doesn't change what really happened. And maybe we just like to think, oh, yeah, you know, she's such a hag that we have to, it has to be her, and we blame her. And it just makes it easier because we can wipe out two things with one, get rid of her and Kurt couldn't have killed himself type thing. It's kind of a thing that we want, I think. But no, personally, no. Any evidence we have shows towards suicide.
Why do you think the stories they were telling so many lies? Was something being covered up or?
No, not at all. Not at all. In fact, you know, and I've talked to the cops that were involved in it and even the follow-up investigation. And the thing is, Green, who was the private eye that Courtney hired, I think he just jumped on. He wanted some money. He was on about a book and a show and making some money. And in fact, even when I asked him to be on the show to represent his documentary, he wouldn't go on it unless I had Courtney and if only if we paid him. I was like, oh yeah, okay, whatever. But every single person we've talked to that you have on that documentary you call, it's not true because they lied. And we have them on our interview telling us, this isn't true. That's not what I said. They've changed this. So that, for me, it just sort of speaks volumes. We have to be realistic about it. And I'm, like I said, I really tried to make sure people know that, yeah, sure, maybe I'm a little bit on Courtney's side because I know her. But at the same time, if I thought for a second she had something to do with it and that she was part of that scheme to kill him, I'd have no problem coming out and saying it.
Well, I didn't mean to put you on the hot seat. I did miss the part where you said that you knew her. So, or at least I forgot that part.
Yeah, I used to hang out up in Capitol Hill. She was there all the time. And we all did coffee together and stuff. And it's, you know, it's just, it was part of the scene at the time in the 90s. It was the grunge. It was what was happening. And I worked at one of the bars that they played in. And I dealt with a lot of the grunge bands as they so became, you know. And it's not a big deal, but I know I've been sort of, some people had said that to me when I started doing these interviews years ago. Some people kind of backed at me, you know, started sending emails. Oh yeah, you're just in with it. And it's like, no, not really. We were acquaintances. We'd hung out together at the time when, but I certainly, I'm not going to make up a story. And we've proved several times how the Detective Green did make up all of these stories. And so I think that was my point of those interviews, was just to show the truth. You can still think she did it. You can still think she's guilty, but not by the evidence he's putting forward.
Yeah. And like I said, I thought it was unlikely given Kurt's mental health background and everything else. It just, to me, it was no shock. It hurt, but it was no shock at all.
Yeah, I think we have to realize about, you know, the mind of someone when you get real popular and you're going out. I think when I heard Billy Corgan of the Smashing Pumpkins say this best, but people don't understand how hard it is to all of a sudden become real famous and everywhere you go, everyone loves you. Then he said, you go to the next stage where everybody says, well, it's not as good as your first album. You know what you should do. And then the third stage where you're no longer that person anymore. And it's very, very depressing. And there was a lot of things going on in his life. He was doing terrible, just an amount of drugs. He was so addicted and he was so screwed up. His mind was just gone. He was doing so much heroin at the time. Mm-hmm. And for so long, you know, and he'd been in and out of rehab and tried to kill himself before. And he was just going through a terrible, terrible time. And, you know, if anything, what Courtney would be guilty of is not being there for him and not really being the support that he needed and not helping him.
And that was reflected in the book.
Well, yeah, and that's the truth. I mean, that is how it is, you know, but at the same time, look at the problem she was having. She was renting the top floor of a hotel in Hollywood, and she was 24/7 doing drugs and partying for weeks at a time. She wasn't in any better state than he was. So I don't know. I don't think she's capable of helping him, but if anything, it was just a mess. And it's one of the unfortunate things, I guess, that comes sometimes with fame.
I thought she was great in The People versus Larry Flint, but she seemed to be playing herself.
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think she's calmed down a lot from what I see. She's doing a lot of good stuff now back east in New York, and she seems to be pretty calm, and we'll see kind of how it goes, but she's much better now that she's out of the big spotlight.
Now, the other one I want to talk about is Bob Crane, and for those that don't know, Bob Crane was Colonel Hogan in Hogan's Heroes. And if you think Colonel Hogan was a womanizer, he had nothing on Bob Crane.
Yeah.
To say the least, Bob had a very salacious lifestyle. And what I find curious, and I want you to shed some light on, is given his lifestyle and the brutal murder that he had, I talk to people and most aren't familiar with this story in any way, shape, or form. And you would think the tabloids would have been all over it. Why don't people know about this story?
It's too old. Even the guy that wrote the foreword for me, he writes in San Francisco, and he was going, and I give him the manuscript before we published it, and I said, can you do a foreword? He said, sure. And then he comes back to me, and he goes, who's Bob Grain? And he's 40. It just sort of, it shocked me. But if you're not into retro television, like watching MeTV or something like that, you might really not know, because Bob Crane, after Hogan's Heroes, really kind of faded away, and then he got killed, and it's forgotten. So if you don't watch reruns or old shows, you would probably have no idea, because we forget. This is what, the 60s and 70s? That's a long time ago. A lot of people we know were born here or in the 80s and 90s. So I think it's just a lot of people don't know. If you say Hogan, they have a better chance of remembering than if you say Bob Crane. That's for sure.
Yeah.
But I knew Bob Crane because of his radio show. He was just fantastic. I just idolized him on the radio and worshipped. He had the most ad-lib skill that was going at the time. And that was before Hogan's Heroes. It was amazing. He was kind of like a Howard Stern, but toned down, way down. But he had this way of just being loose and being himself and being kind of free, which was really, really tough in the 60s in such a uptight sort of time. But he was kind of pulling it off. So that's how I knew him. And Hogan's Heroes was there. Of course, we all knew that, but I could take it or leave it, actually.
And no one was ever charged for that murder. Is that right?
Well, John Carpenter was charged, but he did get acquitted. So there was one person. He was the guy that he was actually a sales rep, and he worked for Sony, I think, originally, and then went to Samsung. Back then, of course, VHS and videotapes was just coming onto the market. And so he was selling it because it was part of Hollywood. It wasn't so common in normal people's homes, but it was common amongst Hollywood. And Bob Crane met him and totally fell in love with the idea of being able to record his sex sessions. That was kind of the real reason I was going to be, but that was it. He thought, this is amazing. And then I can watch these sex movies anytime I want at home. So he was thrilled, and him and John became close friends. And in fact, John started filming half of his sex sessions for him. And the two of them were just having a grand old time. So that was kind of how they met and the premise behind it. And it's a pretty complicated story, too. There's a lot of things going on in that story. It's hard to decide if Carpenter did it or not. Some people blamed the guy that played Newkirk in Hogan's Heroes.
Yes.
And some people blamed his ex-wife because he was going through a terrible divorce. But I also look at, you gotta remember, he was sleeping with a lot of ladies, and a lot of them were married. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them, he filmed them all. And there's probably an upset husband or boyfriend out there somewhere. And that's a big possibility as well, because whoever did kill him, bludgeoned him. I mean, they beat him, and then they tied that string around his neck, and it was a passion hate crime. This wasn't just a robbery. This was not just something gone wrong. This was passion. This was a lot of anger here. So this is someone that's involved with him in some sort of way, and so I don't think we'll ever really know what happened. And they didn't collect the DNA. In fact, one of the detectives, they even found a lot of semen on his leg and when he was in the bed killed, and they just threw it away. And in fact, the cop that I interviewed, he said, well, when he said that to the medical examiner, said, well, what's that going to prove? Which is, he got laid before he got killed? Because he said, why don't we keep it? You know, it's like, so the mentality wasn't there.
And who wants that around?
Yeah. So,
Well, your description of the scene was I mean, there was a lot of blood.
Oh, it's terrible. Yeah, I've got all the pictures, and I got all the files, and even you know, what's really, really sad is because his one son from the second wife who was divorcing him at the time was so mad at him, he took a lot of those pictures and a lot of those sex things, and he built a website, and he sold it to people to watch his dad having sex.
Wow.
So, I mean, that was pretty angry. So I got a lot of those, too. The sons are not scared to share what they have.
Well, and something that you brought up that was interesting is this was the 70s. They didn't have cameras that were the size of a button. This was big camera equipment, and these ladies knew they were being recorded and seemed fine with that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And in fact, that's sort of it. He even would watch it back with a lot of them, and he would have Carpenter join in. He would have different people join in with them. It was just, it was unbelievable what he was doing. And a lot of them were married, and a lot of them were married to wealthy executives and even commercial people. You know. So it's one of those weird stories. It's there's so many different things going on here, and if anything, probably because of that, that controversy. I don't think the cops were as interested as they should have been. But
It doesn't sound like it.
Well, plus they run a terrible scene. He's in there and he's dead, and they let people come in and out and smoke, and they take pictures, and people were using the phone in his Bob Creighton's apartment. They didn't rope it off. It was just totally, you just kind of look at it. Yeah. So it's just like, it was almost nonchalant. Like, who cares? It's crazy. It's just a crazy scene and a crazy murder and all the way down.
I want to talk about your book, Murder Times 6, but before we do, I want to talk a little bit about you.
Uh-oh.
You have a really diverse educational background. How did you end up in radio with so many other degrees and things that you studied?
Well, because ever since I was a kid, I was a radio guy. I was listening to radio as far back as I can remember. Crystal radios, you name it, I had it, and that's all I did. I lived in a fantasy world of radio. So the hard thing is, because I was on the spectrum, I had a real problem communicating, and I couldn't talk. And so, of course, my parents kind of said, well, you know, you'll never be on radio. just put that out of your mind right now. You're not going anywhere with that, you know. And I see exactly what they mean. You know, I couldn't even get on a bike till I was about, I think, 13, and I couldn't ride one till I was about 15. And even then, not very well. So I'm real clumsy, could hardly speak, and real problem with communicating. And so that's the last place you'd think I'd go. But I wanted to so badly that I got myself into radio, but in the back end, producing and engineering and working in the studio itself and working with other shows. So they would be doing, the star would be on and I would record them and write their scripts and do a lot of things on the backside. And at that time, too, I never thought I would ever actually get on the speaker side. It was a complete surprise, and it was an accident. And it was just because I did an interview with which isn't that great, but Judith Baker, who was a girlfriend of Lee Harvey Oswald at the time that he shot the president. And I had a sit down with her and recorded it, and it did really well. And then a station called and said, would you like to do a show? And that's sort of how it happened, but it certainly wasn't planned.
Well, you have me curious then, which came first, becoming a radio personality or your interest in true crime?
Oh, well, you know, I'm actually not that interested in true crime.
Interesting career?
No, I'm not. I just, what happened was criminology was my minor in college and university. It was just, I loved the legal profession itself. I loved the rules and the... It's hard to explain, but there's something about it. But music was more of my passion. You know, music, mathematics would be it. It comes natural. Computers. But it just sort of was something I fell into for fun. And what it was I worked with so many of the cops and met so many and so many different stories. And then when I got onto the radio, then some of them were saying, well, could you write an article for us? And I was just, because writing scripts and then writing articles, and then a publisher approached me and I started writing books. So I kind of got into it that way. And I think the strength that what I realized was when I go meet people like killers or meet in prison, people say, well, how can you do that? I have very little emotion toward it. And I think that's me being on the spectrum. I'm in this fog. So I could sit down and talk about anything, and it doesn't affect me like it does people that are not on the spectrum. They seem to be emotional, and they ask a lot of emotional questions and stuff, and I can cut to the chase and sit in a room and talk with the killer about the details, and it doesn't faze me. And I'm not a sociopath. I feel things, but I just mean that I can just... I don't know. It's one of those things that I can do that I have very, very little problem with. So I do it, I guess that's the best way.
That was something I was curious about. You've had these one-on-one interviews with killers and serial killers, and you had a letter exchange with Hannibal the Cannibal.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if it clouds your outlook on life, but it doesn't sound like
it. No, there's times like, you know, I still feel... and it does affect me afterwards sometimes, but I don't know if it really, I'm too close to myself to tell you if it has an effect. I don't feel like it does, but it probably does. So that's, you know, it's one of those, I'm too close to the object to say, but I think for sure it, I don't think it, yeah, it's weird because I don't think I'm surprised by it. And most of the time when you meet killers, they're not any different than the people you meet in a supermarket.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that, in fact, I've met loonier people out on the road than I have in a institution. Like if really, you know, so I'm more scared of people I've seen on the corner of the road, picketing mask wearing or something, you know, or don't take the vaccine and all this. And I see people with no logic doing these things, and they're much more aggressive and vocal and violent than some of the worst serial killers I've met. So I don't know. They certainly don't make any more sense than the serial killers, but I know.
I can relate to, I lived in Hollywood for a short time, and for the listeners that aren't from California, Hollywood is not paved in gold. It's
no.
It's the exact opposite. And I've seen a few, you see some interesting people out there on the sidewalk there, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's endless.
I'm curious, through your interviews and the exchanges that you have, if you have an opinion on this. Let's talk about serial killers. Do you think they're born or life experiences make them that way, or does it vary?
I think it's both. Life experience itself doesn't seem to do it. It's not logical. Too many people, you know, I've interviewed serial killers that have had almost identical upbringing to mine, with the alcoholic father and just almost the scenarios exactly the same. I have no interest in killing. None at all. You know, I love animals. I'm not cooking them like some of these people. So it isn't just that. It's what you're born with, and then you deal with this circumstance. You see, and sometimes people are not capable of dealing with the circumstance that they're given. I was able to deal with circumstances like you were able to deal. Like, we all have things, and someone with the same life and lifestyle you might have had could be out there doing bad things. It's because they were not equipped to deal with it. So something wrong in their mind, you know, somewhere there was something that happened when they were born. It's something they were born with that they're not capable. And that's where I leave it, because I don't go any further, because that's the best I can describe. I'm not a doctor and I'm not a psychiatrist, but that's the only way I can sort of make it work. And I don't believe someone's born evil. I don't believe in the concept of evil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, evil as a, an entity, you know, like I'm possessed and now I'm going to become a killer. I don't buy that for a second.
But, yeah.
You know, the mind is strong, it's powerful, and it makes up a lot of things. And we are very gullible and we believe in a lot of things because of our feelings. But I don't buy it for a second.
I think I agree with you. It's really complicated. I don't know. It'll be interesting someday when we really have a good idea, a good grasp of just what's going on in the human mind. It's going to take a long time. It's the final frontier.
Yeah, if we make it, it'll be, you know, hundreds of years from now before they really get a total grasp of all that, because it's so entwined with our emotions and what causes our emotions and the reactions and stuff. There's so many things, you know, do we have free will or is it something that's decided before we even decide that that's what we're going to do, right? There's a lot of things that are pretty deep and it causes me too much grief to think about it.
What's your feel about the explosion of all the true crime podcasts that has happened over the past couple of years?
Oh, it gets me into trouble here. I'm take it or leave it because I think people just – listen, I've had true – and I still do people that do podcasts in true crime that come on the show and they co-host during certain episodes. But I'm not a super fan of podcasts. And I think the explosion is just filling the need. It's just like, all the TV shows you see in the networks. It's going to have its run of 10 years and then fade out, just like the paranormal did the last 10 years. It's everywhere you looked and now it's hard to find. It's there, but not like it was. I think it'll be the same. The only problem with the true crime podcasts are most of them are not very good.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not always their fault. A lot of it is because, they're trying to cover cases. So they got 1 week and they're going to do an hour and a half podcast on a crime. And so they got to research it within a week. So they're getting all their information off the internet, you know, off of articles and papers and whatever else or other people's books. So it's all secondhand. And a lot of times they're not very accurate. They miss things. And so I stay away from it for the most part because I will get frustrated when I hear them talking about a story I know. And it's like, well, that's not exactly right. And they forgot, they didn't mention this. And it's not always their fault. They just don't have enough time.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? And the explosion will fade away. Right now, people are just looking to fill that need. And it's already starting to become repetitive, right? You're starting to see the same. How many more movies can you watch on Ted Bundy?
Yeah.
How many more stories can you watch on some of these people and over and over and over again? And it's all saying primarily the same facts because they don't go very deep. Most of them aren't in it for that. Most of them are in it because they're riding the wave. And, you know, all these shows that you see on television, they just kind of go over the same thing. But once we've heard about Ted Bundy, I don't know, 10 times is kind of a bit much.
Yeah.
But for me.
Well, I have never been a fan of him. I haven't heard any that I like. Justine, who does the book recommendations at the beginning of the show, she's a huge podcast fanatic, much more than I am. And she's always recommended shows to me. And she recommended Murder and Martinis. And I don't generally talk badly about another podcast, but fortunately they went off the air starting in February. So I can speak my mind about this show. It was fun in the beginning, but after several episodes, it was 55 minutes of banter and their personalities and how adorable we are together. And then 5 minutes of a murder that seemed like it had been researched on Wikipedia.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of the problem. And that's, you know, that's it. And for the most part, most of them are. So I just leave it at that because it is what it is. But you have to look at it like entertainment. And if you're not into the personality of the people or if you're bored with them, you're not going to like it. So I think that I got to keep it separate. When I do, when we do interviews with people, we do it, the interview part, and then we do our banter. All of that gets on the radio show itself. But the podcast part of it that gets put on afterwards is primarily the interview. Because I find podcast listeners don't want to hear that. They don't want to hear our banter. Or the people that listen to us on radio know us, and they're looking to hear what we have to say about what's going on today. So, you know, we get on and we talk about different things going on, and we kind of make... I like to make people laugh. So primarily the whole show is I want people to smile throughout it. You know, we do have the interview and it's usually a little bit more serious and it's more about the writer or the story or something. And so, that part of it, I don't joke around with. We just kind of do the show. And, but the banter part, we kind of make a lot of fun of things and I try to make people laugh. I don't want them to be uptight. So we're not a serious show, but I think that, I keep that separate from podcast part. The podcast world will complain about that. If you do it too much.
And now get to Murder Time 6. This is your latest book that you've written. And it came out last year. And as I've read 50% of it. And I'm actually glad I didn't finish it because I don't want to give away anything anyway. But you expressed to me why this book is so important now. And I want you to share that.
Well, for me, I think that it's really important. With all my true crime books, I really want people to understand that I don't focus necessarily on all the gruesomeness of the murders. It's more about the concept of how the justice system works for everybody involved in it. In this particular case, you're talking about a guy that got put away for murdering a family of six and raping the two granddaughters and killing them. And the way the justice system works is, of course, he gets six second-degree murder convictions. But on second-degree murder convictions, you serve them all at the same time. It's not one after another. So this man is up for parole here in July. This is a man that murdered six people just so he could rape the grandchildren. You know, so he's a really bad person and does not deserve to be out. But if this is, and it's, I know this case is in Canada, but even Rod Sadler, who just put out that book, Killing Woman, it's the exact same scenario with an American case, and that guy's up for parole as well. It's the same thing because it's how both systems work. We want to rehabilitate in our mind and put these people out, but there's absolutely no way this person should be out and should be your neighbor. Absolutely no way it should be allowed.
Well, something as I was reading it, and it kept making me more and more angry, and I wanted to throw my Kindle against the wall. I don't get this. This man went to this campground and watched the family one night. Right. The next night, he goes back with a 22, walks right into the campground and kills them all. Why is he up for second-degree murder?
Oh, you see, with a lot of these cases, what happens is he's killed all six. All we end up is with the bodies. And in this particular case, all six of them were burned so badly, even after all the you know, testing and lab and all of the forensics, we can't even tell you anything if they were raped or not. So all of our evidence has to come from the killer themselves. And so therefore, they only give you enough to do second degree. There's no way we could prove intent. How can you prove that he premeditated it? Because, you know, as it goes, he didn't tell the police initially that he was stalking them. As far as they knew, he just came across the family, shot them. And in fact, at first, and this is another one, when he killed all six, he told them it was for theft. He stole their boat, and he stole a big pile of things from them. They had a camper and a truck and a car and all this stuff. He stole these things from them, and that's why he killed them. So that's what they had at the time. So they convicted him of the second-degree murders and the theft and robbery and all this stuff because that's what they had. It was Sergeant Eastham that found out later in talking to him that there was a lot more to it. And then we found out even more, and then even me talking to him found out even more. And we'll never really know, to be honest. You can only, because you've got the word of a killer, right? We don't really know, except for what he tells us, how much is true. And with like any person like that, they usually tell you what they think you want them to hear. It's usually some sort of manipulation. There's some sort of thing behind what they're doing. It's not just straightforward and, you know, you can't rely on it. But with my conversation, you could tell he, you know, and how do I say this? You know, when he had the two girls and he took them back to his cabin, you know, for sex, the youngest girl, she's 11. Okay, so she's 11, and he killed her right away. And to me, he said that he was so frustrated because she didn't know how to do anything. He just shot her in the head. And I'm thinking, so, and he said it to me in the way of, like, you know, when you're driving somewhere or you go somewhere and there's something that really bothers you about a store or parking lot or something, and you complain to someone and you want them to agree. So he complained to me that she knew nothing about basically sex is what he's talking about. She didn't know how to do anything. So he just shot her in the head. Like almost he wanted me to say, yeah, she deserved it type thing, or to agree with him. Like, you know what I mean? So he said it in this mannerism, almost like, yeah, you know, she deserved it. And I'm thinking, well, and this guy's up for parole? And then people say, well, it'll never happen. But no, listen, I've got the facts in there. It does happen. 30% of our people get out. The average time a lifer gets out from prison is 22 and a half years. One third of them reoffend. One third of them. Okay. So don't think that they don't get out. They do. And it's so important that people pay attention, because these people are good. That'll be your do you want that guy being your neighbor? You know, or if you have kids or grandkids, do you want that guy living next door when he can be so nonchalant to take someone's life because an 11-year-old didn't know how to perform for him? You know, I just, yeah, and don't think it doesn't. Again, I can add on that he has already been pre-approved for 6-day passes unescorted. So he's going to be able to leave the prison as soon as COVID is over or settled down or in control. The prison's going to give him his 6 passes. He can just walk out of prison for 6 different days in the year. And he, as long as he comes back that night, it's fine.
Yeah. And you didn't initially tell me that. You did tell me that it was important to you because he was coming up for parole this summer.
Right.
And I thought, when I started the book, I thought, well, there's no chance he's going to get parole. And then as I read the book and saw that he got those day passes, I'm like, what the hell?
Yeah.
There is a chance.
There is a huge chance. And you look at the numbers, and it's the same in the U.S. It's not any different. U.S. and Canada, it's very similar with their murder and the way they run the system and the way, you know, with the parole boards, you got to remember that they're there to be successful. Successful to them is to get people out, to get people, as they call it, rehabilitated. So they're judged on their rehabilitation. So that's how many people actually get out. So they're there to protect, not protect. They're there to make sure that criminals get the chance to get out and be rehabilitated in their mind. And so you got to remember that's their job and that's how they're judged. If they keep a majority of people in, they're not going to stay in their job very long, and they're certainly not going to go any further. And I don't want it to sound like we need to attack them. It's the system that needs to change. We need to change that what we're doing with it. And if you read the book later, you'll see that there's one of the family members that, you know, because they all send in their statements, you know, like, you know, this is what it happened and he shouldn't get out because I'm devastated, you know, their personal experience with what happened in the murders and why he shouldn't get out. And I put one in because it was returned from the parole board saying it was too mean.
Too mean.
And when you see it, I wanted people to read it, realize there's not even a swear word in it. And it's too mean because someone, it was just, it's a little too mean. Can you change the way it's worded? And I'm thinking, this is someone's, you took six lives from these people, and they're really, really devastated. So they're writing how they feel. That's what they're supposed to do. It's, you know, it's, that's what it is. And to me, it's not like it was like all these swear words. There was no swear words. It was not aggressive. It was just how devastated they were, how it's wrecked their life and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And I'm thinking, how can that be too mean? What do you want? What do you want her to say? I don't know.
How do you be too mean to a man who did six grisly murders anyway?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't want to get into a debate on the death penalty, but I will say I'm totally against it, but I'm 100% murder, no parole, you're in there for the rest of your life. You just can't take that risk.
Yeah, there's no reason to be letting people out and stuff, because this guy now, he's found Jesus, you know. Jesus hangs out in the cells. I don't know, because it's like these killers always find them. So now he's converted to Jesus, and it's got a new wife, and she's like, he's got a beautiful soul and all blah, blah, blah. But that's okay from a fresh point of view. Maybe to her, he is a beautiful guy and maybe things are good, but you can never put that back in people's lives. He killed six people from one family. How do you make up for that? And just because he's come to peace with his Lord, that doesn't make it okay. And that doesn't mean that he should be allowed to come out and be your neighbor. I think that's too far. I think that, you know, he's a good boy and he's been in there, give him a TV, you know, whatever. But, you know, to let them out and it's just, he's done too much. You cannot make up for that. And the thing is, there's too many people still alive that are totally there and part of it. Like a lot of the family, when I'm interviewing them, they're bawling their eyes out. This happened in the 80s, and it's like it happened yesterday to these people. And a lot of them are only in their 50s, and they're not that old. They still have a life to live. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, so it's just not fair. He does not need to be out, period.
Yeah. This were parents, grandparents, and their children.
Yeah.
This is three generations.
Yeah, and like for no reason other than he wanted to rape the two little girls. That says it all. To me, that's like, okay, that's, you know, and when people say, well, yeah, but he's better now, and he's claiming that he doesn't have these sexual urges for children anymore, and since he's been married, he only thinks of adult females now. Okay, let's just put that aside and say, okay, it's true. It's all true. What about the cops he tried to kill? Mm-hmm. Three times. And what about the guy he ran over on some sort of bad drug deal and killed and got a manslaughter? He has no problem taking people's lives, and it's nothing to do with children. He didn't try to kill those cops because of any kids he was trying to get or anything like that. He killed them because he didn't care about them and he needed to get rid of them. So they can't win with that point for me. You know, it's just like, no. You know, and again, could you imagine being one of the cousins or one of the family members? You're 50 years old, and then you know he's out and he's living in the same city as you again?
No, I can't imagine that at all.
That's just too much. It's too much. I will never, ever agree with letting that man out, but who am I?
Well, so what's coming next from you? And I think you have a new book coming?
Well, I've got two. I got a project that I've been doing. What happened was I'm doing Killer Queen, Kill the Queen is an assembly of gay killers. Now, what it is a sampling of the different types of it's their psychological profile, and I've got some of their interviews with the psychiatrists and kind of what they went through as a child and then what they did. And it's not really focusing. I don't go through all these crime scenes and all that. It's more about a perspective of what makes someone kill. And there's different kinds of reasons why people kill, and especially when it comes to sex. And so it's covering that. But what I did was that during that time, I found Fritz Haarmann, who was the butcher of Hanover.
Mm-hmm.
And he killed 27 boys and young men. Raped them and killed them. And I have his trial, and I have his all of his own words and the detectives, and I got a lot of the story. So I think that's taken me a little longer because all of the records that come from the court and the police were all in German, so I had to have them all translated. My eyes are bleeding. No, so it takes a lot of work. And so that in itself, The Butcher of Hanover, will be its own standing book, but he's involved in the Killer Queen book as well. And then I think I'll write some fun stuff for a change. I hope. I keep saying that, but it never happens.
No, you're used to the other stuff.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll try fiction.
I think you would be good at it based on your background.
Oh, I don't know. I'm scared.
It's a scary thing. I will tell you that.
Well, I just don't know how you can come up with characters. See, I get the characters, and I have to try and figure out what happened and try to figure out how they work together and how they act. People like you that write things have to come up with it from your own mind, your own imagination. And I don't know, because I've done so many of the real things, I don't know how many would not get. How it wouldn't cross in, you know? I don't know if I can do it. I don't know. But I got to write something happy.
Yeah. Self-help book or something.
Yeah, that's it. Like I'm going to help some.
Okay, for the listeners, I'm going to remind them, this is Alan R. Warren, my guest today. His latest book is Murder Time 6, and I can tell you from having read half of it, go get it. I basically read the investigation. I think the last half is more your investigation, if I'm right.
Yeah.
And he's the host of House of Mystery, which covers paranormal, crime, religion, science, history, on a variety of media outlets. It's in its 10th year on NBC in Los Angeles, Riverside, Palm Springs, and other stations. And then after it airs, it's available on his website or pretty much anywhere you listen to podcasts. So thank you, Alan. It's been wonderful to have you on the show.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Be sure to subscribe to Queer Writers of Crime wherever you hear our show. Tell a friend, too. Thank you for listening.